Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we'll take you to Portland and the Abramson Center at the University of Southern Maine for a speech by George Mitchell. Hailing from Waterville, Mitchell is a former United States District Court judge and a United States Senator. He was the special envoy for Northern Ireland under former President Bill Clinton and was most recently the special envoy for Middle East peace under President Barack Obama. He is also the founder of the Mitchell Institute, which provides college scholarships for Maine students. He recently spoke at the annual meeting of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at any time or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Lisa Pullman, Executive Director of the Natural Resources Council of Maine.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Pullman, and I am the Executive Director of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. I'd like to welcome you to NRCM's 2011 membership meeting. It is wonderful to see so many of our friends, our members, and supporters here gathered to join our keynote speaker, Senator George Mitchell, and also to celebrate the accomplishments of our 2011 environmental awardees. In fact, Senator Mitchell received an NRCM Environmental Award not too long ago. So before I begin, let me take this opportunity to thank Lee Auto Malls and also PDT Architects, who have generously helped with this event. The environment of Maine is very special. Our forests and mountains, coastline, rivers, and lakes are at the heart of our Maine traditions. They provide the backbone of our economy and the basis of our quality of life. For decades now, we have worked together so that our air and water are cleaner, more of our wildlife and fisheries are thriving, and our vast northern forest remains intact. These elements of our special place hold the key to Maine's future, and that's why we need to keep working together to protect them. The Natural Resources Council of Maine is the largest, most effective nonprofit organization that has worked to safeguard Maine's environment for the last 50 years. With a team of experts on our staff and thousands of supporters like you, we have changed this place for the better by protecting and restoring the essential nature of Maine that sustains us all. We know it's up to us to ensure that our precious natural resources are here for the health and happiness of our children and future generations. Our success comes from leadership. It comes by finding common ground in the midst of disagreement. It comes with negotiation and partnership. It comes because we are courageous and stand our ground. This year, we have faced a challenge like never before. In our legislature, there were suddenly dozens of attempts to weaken or completely do away with our safeguards for Maine's land, air, water, and wildlife. Many of these proposals, like repealing our bottle recycling law or our electronic waste law, were initiated by corporations with no ties to Maine. But the Natural Resources Council of Maine let the public know what was happening, and people from all across the state, from all walks of life, responded swiftly and loudly. In many cases, we had to stand our ground and just say no. As a result, many of these rollback proposals were ultimately defeated. Sometimes we could negotiate. For example, the out-of-state chemical industry helped draft a bill that would have gutted our Kids Safe Products Act. This law helps to phase out the most harmful chemicals in consumer products that come in contact with our children. Lawmakers had to pay attention when State House hearing rooms were packed with moms and professors and physicians and industry groups. NRCM staff and partner groups worked through disagreements, and in the end, a bipartisan bill was enacted with broad support because it actually improved the existing law. Through leadership and persistence, we found common ground and a way forward. Now, there are many challenges still ahead, and I ask you all to stay engaged, stay vigilant, and stay with us. Maine has a history of strong policy leadership on many fronts and on both sides of the aisle, and I am honored to have such a leader with us today, a man who has led the nation at pivotal moments when the health of our environment was at stake. In his long and distinguished career of public service, Senator George Mitchell represented Maine in the U.S. Senate from 1980 to 1995. He led the successful 1990 reauthorization of the Clean Air Act, focused on curbing acid rain, ozone depletion, urban smog, and industrial emissions of toxic chemicals. He was also the author of the first national oil spill prevention and cleanup law. Now, he is known very well for his involvement in the Northern Ireland peace talks that resulted in the Good Friday Agreement and the decades of conflict between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. For this service, Senator Mitchell has received numerous awards and honors, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor given by the United States government. Senator Mitchell now serves as a chairman emeritus of DLA Piper, one of the largest legal service firms in the world. He is also the founder of the Senator George J. Mitchell Scholarship Research Institute that awards scholarships to one graduating student from every public high school in Maine. I know he has learned a thing or two about finding common ground that he will share with us today. It is my great pleasure to introduce Senator George Mitchell.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Lisa, for your generous introduction. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your warm reception. It's an honor and a privilege for me to be here today to spend a few minutes talking about some of the challenges and opportunities our country faces. It's a special pleasure to be here on a day and at an event where you honor some distinguished Maine citizens who've contributed so much to the protection of our environment and the enhancement of the lives of others in Maine. And I want to acknowledge the awards will go to Judy Kellogg Markowski, whose brothers are here today, Brownie Carson, who's here with his wife, Dana. Brownie is a dear friend of many, many years. Sandra Wright, who is here with her husband, and the Belfast Co-Housing and Eco Village, represented by Santa McKinn and others from that area. Please join me in acknowledging and thanking them for their contributions. Thank you all very much. When Lisa asked me if I would come to speak here today, I hesitated. As you know from her introduction, it's been quite a few years since I left the Senate, and in the past couple of years, I've spent much of my time out of the country and haven't felt up to date on a lot of issues, including the issues you are most concerned with. And I know from my past experience that this is a group of experts in the field of environmental protection. And so I was hesitant about coming up and talking on a subject in which I felt almost everyone in the audience knows more about it than I do. But then I reflected on my early days in the Senate. And so I want to tell that story and explain why I eventually accepted. As you may know, I served as a federal judge here in Maine before I was appointed to the Senate. Senator Muskie resigned to become Secretary of State. Joe Brennan was the governor, and He said he was not going to take long to appoint a successor because it was in the middle of a legislative session and he didn't want Maine to be underrepresented in the U.S. Senate. So there was a lot of speculation. There were several highly qualified candidates, a former governor, a former senator, former congressman. Since I had been appointed a federal judge just the year before, my name was not included in the speculation, and it didn't occur to me that I might be chosen. So on the day before the governor's announcement, Joe Brennan called me, and he said that he wanted to appoint me to complete Senator Muskie's term. I said, "Well, Joe, this is really a surprise." I said, "I got to think about this. I've got to talk about it with the members of my family, especially my three older brothers." I grew up in Waterville. I had three older brothers, all of whom were great and very prominent athletes. And then I came along, and I was not as good as my brothers. In fact, I was not as good as anybody else's brother. And at an early age, I became known around Waterville as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. As you might expect, I developed a massive inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers. So on that evening that Joe Brennan called me, I immediately called my three brothers, ostensibly to seek their advice. But I confess there was a note of triumphalism in my voice. As I said to them, "The governor wants to appoint me to the Senate. What do you guys think about that?" The response was predictably negative. My brother Johnny said, "Look," he said, "everybody knows you're a born loser." He said, "Nobody can understand how you got to be a federal judge. You couldn't possibly win an election in Maine, and so you ought to stay where you are." My older brother sought to lift it to a higher plane, and so he said, "As a citizen of Maine, I believe that the people of Maine are entitled to have a qualified person representing them in the Senate." So after about 15 minutes of this, I called the governor and I said, "Governor, I've received all the reassurance I need. I'll be there tomorrow." So I went to Washington, and I was sworn in. And the Senate was in session and debating. And in fact, they cast a vote within 2 minutes after I became a senator. For those of you interested in political trivia, I hold the all-time record for having cast a vote the shortest time after entering the Senate, 2 minutes. That was the first of many informed judgments I made on your behalf. Well, then a few minutes later, a young man walked up to me, and he introduced himself as my new chief of staff. He had been Senator Muskie's chief of staff. Now he was mine. And he took out a card with a lot of stuff printed on it, and he read off to me a list of things that I was to do that day. And he concluded by saying, "We have a wonderful invitation here. The National Association of Certified Public Accountants has its annual convention here in Washington, and they just called, they must have seen you being sworn in on television, and asked if you would come down to deliver the keynote address at their convention this evening." I said, "Gosh," I said, "it's just amazing." I said, "Until yesterday, I myself didn't know I'd be here. To think that they held this important slot open for me." "Oh, no," he said, "it's nothing like that." He said, "They've had 4 last-minute cancellations." He said, "You're the only member of Congress they could think of who might not have anything to do tonight." I said, "Well, what do they want me to talk about?" He said, "The tax code." I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "You want me to talk to 2,000 certified public accountants about the tax code? I said, I can't do that. They all know more about it than I do. He said, listen, he said, you're now a United States senator. You will be regularly called upon to speak in public on subjects you know nothing about. He said, so you better get started. So I went down, and I told the CPAs about the tax code. And when I thought about that, Lisa, here I am to tell a couple of hundred experts about the environment. So I'm glad I accepted, and I thank Lisa for asking me, and I thank you all, especially for your very warm reception. We live in a time of polarized politics and intense partisanship. The path to common ground seems beyond reach on just about every topic. It would be easy to despair, to throw up our hands in frustration about what's happening, and especially about what's not happening, on the federal budget, on jobs, on education, on climate policy, on environmental protection. We're not making progress at the pace needed to deal with the many challenges we face here at home or abroad. But I believe that we must and we should have hope, and that we must and we should do all we can to help reason and logic prevail. A strong anti-environment theme is emerging among some in this country, criticizing environmental laws, and the work of the EPA is rising. But this has happened before, and I sincerely believe that reason and logic and the national interest can and will once again prevail. The political gridlock, the proposed rollback of our nation's basic environmental laws, the attacks on the science behind climate change. As alarming as these may seem, they also are familiar. Our recent history has been marked by alternating cycles of progress and retrenchment, a step forward and then a step backward. But I believe that the American people and the power of their common sense eventually will lead us back to a more productive path of reasoned discourse and sound policymaking. Many of you may think this sounds like hopeless idealism, but idealism has been a driving force throughout all of American history. I saw it in Senator Muskie, the greatest environmental legislator in our nation's history. When I worked for him, he stood up to powerful polluting industries to build momentum and support for what became the Clean Water Act. I saw it throughout my 15 years in the Senate, including during periods when the partisan divide then seemed as wide and intractable as it is today. And we've all seen efforts over many years to turn environmental protection into a scapegoat for whatever are our nation's economic ills. But it doesn't last, because over time it has become clear that the American people want and support clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment. For perspective, I want to read to you a few statements by recent political leaders, and I encourage you to make a mental guess of who is speaking before I identify them. While I am a great believer in the free enterprise system and all that it entails, I am an even stronger believer in the right of our people to live in a clean and pollution-free environment. That was Barry Goldwater. Clean air, clean water, open spaces, These should once again be the birthright of every American. That was Richard Nixon. Our nation's continued prosperity hinges on our ability to solve environmental problems and sustain the natural resources on which we all depend. That was John McCain in 1996. The evidence is sufficient that we should move toward the most effective possible steps to reduce carbon loading of the atmosphere. That was Newt Gingrich in 2007. Now, I know what many of you are thinking. Words are easy, deeds are hard. It may be that their actions did not always precisely live up to their words. But isn't that true of all political leaders? Indeed, isn't it true of all of us in every one of our daily lives? And isn't it better to have than to not have high aspirations, even if we at times fall short of meeting them? And please remember that political leaders, no matter the party, often can be good barometers of public sentiment. President Bush Sr. supported and played a critical leadership role in enactment of the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, a bill that I sponsored, that I devoted a large part of my life and was passionate about getting enacted. President Bush deserves a lot of credit for his leadership on that issue. We included in that act a cap and trade proposal that was proposed by President Bush and pushed by Republicans at the time because it was seen as a market-based alternative to regulatory control. So, not too long ago, Republicans were champions for cap and trade. That's because they sincerely believe that it can be a cost-effective strategy for achieving environmental progress. The Clean Air Act amendments focused on curbing acid rain, ozone depletion, industrial emissions of toxic chemicals, and urban smog. And they have done so. The Office of Management and Budget concluded that the acid rain program within the Clean Air Act amendments has resulted in human health benefits valued at more than $70 billion annually as a result of reductions in sulfur emissions from power plants. The acidity in rainfall plummeted across the Northeast, and total benefits exceeded implementation costs by 40 to 1. This is not unique to the Clean Air Amendments. It's true across a range of environmental laws and regulations. The most recent Office of Management and Budget assessment of regulations issued by the Environmental Protection Agency found that EPA had issued 30 regulations over the past decade, with overall benefits exceeding costs by anywhere from 4 to 1 to 50 to 1. And think about what the Clean Water Act, also Senator Muskie did both clean air and clean water. And think about what the Clean Water Act has done for Maine and what a tremendous legacy he provided for our state and our nation. The Kennebec, the Androscoggin, the Penobscot, they were all open sewers in the 1960s, essentially devoid of fish. Look at them now. As a result of the Clean Water Act, they have growing populations of many important fish species. Shorefront property values have increased along our rivers, and our waterfront towns have turned their orientation back toward the rivers. People can actually swim in waters in Maine that 40 years ago you wouldn't have dipped a toe into. Similar successes have taken place all over the country. Maine people understand the value of a clean environment, and so do people all across America. In the face of today's economy, the challenge now, more than ever, is to promote environmental protection and economic development, not to try to force a false choice between the two. We can do that. We must do that, especially as we wrestle with the imperative of reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and increasing our energy independence as a central strategy to address the threat of climate change. Some of our political leaders have said that climate change is not real, but I believe that this anti-science view will fade away in coming years. Remember, it took a long time for people to accept that the Earth is not flat, or that the Earth orbits around the sun. But as the scientific evidence keeps piling up, proving that climate change is real, that human activity creates a large portion of the problem, and that it's urgent that we respond at a local, a regional, a national, indeed a global level. This will be hard work. It will take a long time, but there isn't any realistic alternative. We're moving into an era of human history when a changing climate will impose major economic and environmental challenges on the entire globe. It will test the limits of human creativity, innovation, political will, and social structures. But I'm confident that we can and will rise to the challenge. I believe that because I have faith in the ability of the American people to meet the challenges of our time, as Americans before us have met the challenges of their times. I have faith in our political system to ultimately act for the benefit of our people. And I believe that our elected leaders will ultimately be forced to lead by the broad majority of our people, who will demand common sense solutions to the problems that we face. We can get to common ground for the protection of our planet, and we must. All of you here today need to help. I came here today primarily because I believe that we need organizations like the Natural Resources Council of Maine. It's been a leader and a force for environmental protection in Maine for the past 50 years. From your work to protect the Allegash Wilderness Waterway, to your efforts in drafting and helping secure enactment of some of Maine's landmark environmental laws, yours is one of the organizations that helps protect what is special about Maine. And you've done it all because it made common sense. And when you think about it, that's what Maine people are all about. Thank you. Keep up the good work. Let's all get together to protect our environment, our health, and our globe. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Senator Mitchell. Many of you were good enough to send in questions for the senator, and we have just about 10 minutes for him to give some additional comments. We have selected a few of these questions, so it will go like this. Senator Mitchell, how can we persuade the general public, which can be tossed and turned by all that they hear in the media, all sides, how can we persuade them to continue to protect the environment? What would you have to say about that?
I answered that in my comments, and I'll repeat and expand on them. All of us have an obligation in each of our daily lives, in whatever form is available to us, to make the case that our environment does need protection, that climate change is a real threat, and that not just we, but more importantly, our children and future generations depend upon our willingness to act to meet those challenges now. The principal argument made by those who are anti-science is a more sophisticated one than simply denial. It is that while the evidence is mixed, it isn't certain. Before we impose costs on our economy, we have to wait until the evidence is absolutely certain. Well, the answer to that is if we wait until there are no doubters and no skeptics, it will be too late to act. And the reality is that as individuals in our daily lives and in all human institutions, private and public, up to and including the national government, decisions are routinely made on less than total certainty. By definition, they have to be. You can't live a life of uncertainty and indecision until it is true beyond any doubt whatsoever that a fact exists. Otherwise, we'd be in suspended animation in our personal lives and governments. And think back of the enormous and fateful decisions that have been made by leaders of governments throughout all of human history on less than perfect information. And the one thing that I think is indisputable is that a delay sufficient to meet that standard of certainty will mean that it's too late to prevent the negative from happening. So inaction is as much a choice as is action. And inaction must be weighed against the risks that it entails just as much as we impose the analysis on action.
Given our current political system, which feels very broken sometimes, do you think it's capable of overcoming the corporate and partisan opposition and bickering to address serious environmental problems that are as big as climate change? You know, time's a-wasting. What needs to happen for this to change?
Yes, I do. And I think we ought to keep this in context. It is a human tendency to view the past with rose-colored glasses. Let's be realistic. There has never been a time in American history when there wasn't partisanship, when there wasn't bickering, when there weren't personal attacks, when it wasn't rough and tumble. Go back and read the history of the Founding Fathers, the attacks on Washington, the attacks on Jefferson, the personal disputes that marked the formative period of our country. Go back and look at what was said about Lincoln. It'll make you blush even now about the things that were said about him. He was ridiculed for his appearance, for his voice, for his background. There's nothing new about this. In terms of conflict, what is new are a number of factors that prove the old adage that every bit of progress brings with it some potential disadvantage. Ubiquitous nature of television, the powerful emotional effect it has, as one thing to have read about an attack on Jefferson in a newspaper a month after it happened. It's another thing to see it on the cable news network, and if it's sensational enough or wild enough, it'll be repeated over and over again. The huge infusion of money into our political system, the recent decision by the Supreme Court, I fear, will have a dramatic negative effect on raising spectacularly the amount of money that pours into our system and is corrupting in the sense that it causes people to lose faith in their elected representatives, which ultimately is corrosive and potentially fatal in a democratic society. And so there are real problems, and it is very difficult. And it is, in fact, more difficult than it was when I was Senate Majority Leader, although we thought it was tough at the time. But in the end, over and over again in our history, whatever the circumstances or the technology or the problems of the time, the people of our country have made the right decisions. Arguably, one of the best items of evidence of the greatness of American society is that we have spent so much time and energy trying to right the wrongs that our country has been engaged in, or the mistakes that we've made, and we've done so in an open and sometimes rough and tumble way. And I think it can happen again. But it means that all of us can't sit around and just be upset about the situation. We've got to try to do something about it. We've got to be active. That's why it means something that you're part of this organization. Now, I happen to be in a position where I have access to the public's attention more than, say, an individual private citizen, which is one reason why I choose to make these comments in public. I'm going to do a press conference afterward. I'll repeat it. Those of us who have the chance to do so have to get out there and make the case. And I think it can be made. I think we have to have faith in the ultimate wisdom and common sense of the American people. And remember, when you see a lot of these statements on television, keep one thing in mind, and I like to tell a story because people remember stories. They don't remember anything else I say, but you remember the stories. When we were battling to get the Clean Air Act amendments passed, it took a very long time, years, months on the Senate floor, hundreds of amendments. A very difficult slog. And we were negotiating, and we were very close. And the Washington Post ran a big story which focused entirely on the remaining disputes. It didn't say they've solved A, B, C, D. It said they haven't solved E and F. And so I saw the reporter, and I complained about it. And he said, "Senator, you have never seen and you never will see a headline that says 2 million commuters made it safely to work today." You will see headlines that said 2 cars crashed and 6 people were killed. It's just the nature of the human condition that controversy makes news, drama makes news, and so we have to fight through that, but we can do so. We've done so in the past, and we can do so again.
How about this one? If you could give President Obama one piece of advice on preserving the environment, what would it be?
I had met President Obama before I reentered government at his request in 2009, but I didn't know him well. I left the Senate before he entered. I spent a lot of time with him and working in his behalf in the past couple of years. And I found him to be intelligent, thoughtful, reasonable, and I support him and will work very hard in his behalf in the coming election. If I were to give him a piece of advice, it would be repetitious of what he's obviously heard and what he's acting on, in that he's got to get out and fight. He's got to stand up and make the case in the teeth of determined opposition, which often, as I said a moment ago in discussing climate change, creates a context which makes the argument seem reasonable when upon analysis it's clear that they're not. And that takes determination. It takes repetition. I can tell you from personal experience, I campaigned all over the state, and after you give the same speech 200 or 300 times, you kind of get tired of it. But you've got to make the same case over and over again because the demands on our attention are so great that it requires a consistent message and a consistent effort. And I'll say one of the reasons for the success of some of those who we would regard as opponents is that they're very disciplined in delivering the same message over and over again. And while it may, those arguments often strike us as ridiculous and simplistic, we have to accept the fact that if repeated often enough, they will penetrate to the public. And we have to combat them with a clear, direct message on the merits, based on sound science and reason, but with the same degree of force, intensity, and repetition.
Last question. Where would you like to see Maine and the nation 10 years from now in regards to stewardship of our environment?
I have to say I think overall, not to be self-congratulatory, but we've done a pretty good job. I mentioned the rivers earlier. I grew up in Waterville. My mother was an immigrant. She couldn't read or write. My father was the orphan son of immigrants. He had no education. My mother worked in textile mills. My father was a janitor. And when I grew up, the poorest place in town, the only place they could afford to live, was right on the banks of the Kennebec River. If you stepped out of our back door, you stepped right into the river. And the reason was, it was filthy. It was covered with scum all the time. There was a paper mill just across and upriver. There was a textile mill a few hundred yards away. There were few, if any, controls on municipal or other forms of sewage. And my father thought, in his own modest way, that he had accomplished something really great in his life. When I was 6 years old, we moved about 100 yards away from the river. Now, it's hard to imagine now when you think about shorefront property and all that it entails, but there are people who grew up on other rivers in Maine who know what I'm talking about. It was a huge accomplishment. We were 100 yards away from the river, and boy, we had really made a big step up in life. So I look at it as though, yes, of course there have been problems. Yes, of course we haven't done all we want. But before Ed Muskie passed the Clean Water Act, 85% of the waters of the United States were heavily polluted. Those numbers are now reversed. 85% of the waters of the United States are clean enough for people to fish in, to swim in, to engage in other recreational or productive economic activities. That's not a bad record. So I don't think we should hang our heads about what's happened or about what will happen. I think we should go into the future proud of the record that we've accomplished and build upon it to meet future challenges, and let's be clear about one thing, to improve the things we've done. The human condition is not static. No legislation is ever perfect and immutable. We have to keep looking at issues, keep looking at problems, keep looking at laws, change them as needed to meet changing circumstances, and enact laws as necessary to meet new challenges. So, I'm frankly pretty optimistic about what we've done and about what we can and will do, and I don't think we should be overwhelmed or driven to despair by some of the sensational voices that we hear, particularly those that are so, I use the word anti-science, so skeptical about scientific developments. We've overcome this kind of challenge before, and I believe we can do so again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was former U.S. Senator and diplomat George Mitchell. He recently spoke in Portland at the annual meeting of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. You can listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.